From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. When Gia Tolentino joined the venerable New Yorker magazine as a staff writer 3 years ago, she was just 27. She was formerly deputy editor at Jezebel, a talented writer who's quickly become one of the smartest, most interesting voices of her generation. In fact, some are calling her the voice of her generation. Tolentino has chronicled everything from the rise of vaping to the nexus where religion and drugs met in her own life, to her deeply thoughtful essays on the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, and her loyal critique of feminism. That work is now wrapped up in a new book of essays, This Hour on Point, Reflections on the World Through Gia Tolentino's Trick Mirror. And Gia Tolentino joins us today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. As I mentioned before, she joined The New Yorker in 2016. She was deputy editor at the feminist website Jezebel, and her new book is called Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. Gia Tolentino, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It is great to have you. You are one of the people that every week when I get my New Yorker, I look in the table of contents to see if your byline is there.
And I love ruining it every week.
Well, if your writing is what we called ruination, bring on some more ruination, I have to say. But so I'm really excited to talk with you. First of all, let me just ask you. I in the intro there, I mentioned, and I know you've seen this before, that folks are calling you, at the ripe old age of 30, now the voice of your generation. What do you think of that?
I find that, I mean, you know, there are a lot of people that are my age that are writing that are extremely vital. And I think that singling anyone out, I mean, this is something that I write in my book. I think that singling someone out is sort of representative of, like, I prefer the thing to the representation of the thing in general. And, yeah, I mean, I don't consider myself the voice of, like, it's, you know, too bad for my generation if I'm what we've got, you know? I think what people are talking about when they say that, because I've been thinking about that because it's, you know, again, certainly not a way that I would ever think about myself. I think that what people are talking about is there are certain things that the millennial generation has in common, right? There are certain, we came of age between the recession of 2008 and the election in 2016. We have seen sort of accelerated capitalism grow to encompass and seep into every last corner of life. We've grown up with the internet. Like, we've grown up, we went from not having the internet as kids to, you know, the totalization of the internet and, you know, it being the central organ of contemporary culture. There are certain things that have sort of delineated the millennial era and the millennial condition. And a lot of them lead, I think, to this undercurrent of kind of dread and desire, you know, this sort of ambient dread of the future and the desire to make something of it. And I think that those are two qualities that are in almost everything I write, that sense of dread and desire.
Dread and desire. Well, yeah. I mean, so in the intro to your book, you write about how you dove into writing this book, what, in the spring of 2017 to the over the next year after that?
Yeah. You know, I think like a lot of people, I woke up the morning after the election and I felt so upset at the sense of certainty that I had felt beforehand and so conscious of how it had led me wrong. And I was so, you know, brutally and kind of permanently aware of the fact that for the foreseeable future, understanding a situation wouldn't necessarily mean being able to do anything about it or being able to do what you wished you would be able to do about it. I sort of saw this enormous gap between a moral understanding of something and what would actually happen. You know, like, we could understand the morality of the issues at stake in the election. We can understand the morality of, you know, the border separation crisis, the, you know, the climate crisis, and it doesn't always seem to translate into what we would want it to. And that sense was so apparent to me then and since. And I was just sitting with that for a while. And, you know, I was, you know, when you're a writer, your job is to try to make sense of things, right? And I, at the same time, I was suffused with this deep feeling of uncertainty. And I was sort of thinking about, you know, what use is there? You know, is there a use of trying to be clear in a world where clarity is not readily available? You know, is there a way to think about morality in a world where, you know, most of our systems seem to be accelerating towards maximum immorality? Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking about this and thinking about this. And, you know, like a lot of people, I was confused, and I was, you know, full of just kind of ambient agony. And, you know, early in 2017, I started thinking, well, one way to turn feelings of confusion and ambient agony into something that might be useful is to write a book.
And why not, right?
Why not?
Write through our confusion. But
write straight into it, really, right? I figured I wouldn't be able to write my way out of it, but I wanted to see what that could teach me.
I do want to engage with several of the specific essays in your book here.
Sure.
But first, though, there's one more thing in the introduction, which I thought was very brave, because you write that throughout this period that we're talking about, 2017, 2018, you found that you could hardly trust anything that you were thinking. And the reason why I say that I feel it's very brave for you to put that right there in the beginning of your book is because...
Great advertisement.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people actually, they feel quite the opposite, that for the very reasons you outlined over the past couple of years, people are actually more certain than ever about their thinking. Perhaps erroneously, but forms of absolutism have really, I think, entrenched themselves across American life. And here you are saying you're not sure about that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think I understand that sense of absolutism from a certain point of view. Like, for example, you know, my point of view on, you know, I mentioned the border separation crisis, but, you know, like there are certain things, like there's no, you know, it's a pretty black and white issue, right? I'm not saying that, you know, like, how do we know what's right and wrong about these, like, extremely morally obvious situations, right? I mean, I understand that to some, you know, significant degree. But what I meant by saying I could hardly trust anything that I was thinking was that, you know, I think that, well, one thing that contemporary life sort of asks us to consider the world, the one lens that the contemporary world is using a lot is like, is this thing good or bad? You know, is this situation good or bad? And that those questions tend to be easy to answer, and they tend not to feel useful to me anymore. Like, I think that's what I meant. Like, I understood that things were good and bad, but I didn't understand where that understanding would take me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question, I see this, I know what I believe, but now what? Like,
right.
That was the question that I was wanting to push into.
Okay. So, if you could, I'd love if you could actually read a little bit from the first essay in your book, Trick Mirror, because as you write, you wanted to explore like the places, as you say, the spheres of public imagination that have shaped who you are and that mm-hmm. understanding of your understanding, as you said. The first one, front and center, is the internet. So could you read from an excerpt from the first chapter of your book?
Yeah. So the internet can feel like an astonishingly direct line to reality. Click if you want something and it'll show up at your door 2 hours later. A series of tweets goes viral after a tragedy, and soon there's a nationwide high school walkout. But it can also feel like a shunt diverting our energy away from action, leaving the real world sphere to the people who already control it, keeping us busy figuring out the precisely correct way of explaining our lives. In the run-up to the 2016 election, and increasingly so afterwards, I started to feel that there was almost nothing I could do about 95% of the things I cared about other than form an opinion, and that the conditions that allowed me to live in mild, everyday hysterics about an unlimited supply of terrible information were related to the conditions that were, at the same time, consolidating power, sucking wealth upward, far outside my grasp.
That's Gia Tolentino reading an excerpt from the first chapter of her book. The book is called Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. And that first chapter is titled The Eye in the Internet. So, Gia, in reading your multiple essays that deal with the internet and social media, I'm not quite sure I really get how you feel about it. Like, how do you feel about social media and the internet?
Well, you know, I think the question is it good or is it bad? And the answer is, you know, it's a lot of both, right? It's a lot of both. I think that I, you know, and also in some ways, that's a question that I hardly asked myself, because it doesn't matter how I feel about it, right? It doesn't matter how any of us feel about the internet. It's already inserted itself as the central organ of life today, mm-hmm. right? It's the sphere through which our politics, our personal relationships, our lives are routed through. The way we hear about culture, the way we hear about, you know, crisis, the way we hear about disaster, it's all routed through the internet. Our work is routed through the internet, you know, all the way through, if you're a factory worker, if you're a warehouse worker, through if you're, you know, a creative class knowledge worker in, you know, a coastal city, it's all routed through the internet. And I think one of the reasons that I put this internet essay first was that one thing that I think is very interesting about it is that the sort of the economic engine of the internet is selfhood.
Right.
And that, I think, puts a really interesting pressure on the self, right? The biggest social platforms, they are structured, they're designed in such a way to position our personal identity, you know, our profiles, the little text box that asks us what we want to say. That's the very center of the way we interact with the world. And, you know, our data is what they, you know, the data on our preferences and our choices and the questions we ask Google, like, this is what is sold and resold. Like, you know, selfhood is the petroleum for the internet. And I find that really, you know, that's really interesting.
Well, and then to just crib off the subtitle of your book, doesn't that make the internet the primary engine of our self-delusions?
Yeah, I mean, I think I say in the book that there's something about the internet that makes it, it's like a vantage point through which you can see the entire world, but a lot of it looks like your own reflection.
Well, we are talking this hour with Gia Tolentino. She is a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine. She's out with a new book of essays called Trick Mirror: Reflections on Self-Delusion. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Gia Tolentino. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Prior to that, she was deputy editor of the feminist website Jezebel, and she has a new book of essays out. It's called Trick Mirror: Reflections on Self-Delusion. And we have an excerpt of Gia's book at onpointradio.org. And Gia, there's so much more to explore in your book, and I promise you we will, but I don't fully yet want to leave the internet as an area of exploration, because I just think you really are, in my opinion, one of the most lucid writers about sort of not just the totality of how the internet influences our lives, but how sort of like mentally and spiritually and emotionally we occupy the internet. And so to that point, I just want to play a little bit of music here that is from a March 2018 New Yorker article you wrote. So here it is. So that, of course, is Toto and Africa. But
I'm crying in the booth already.
Because it sounds like it's being played in an abandoned mall.
Yeah.
Okay, I had never heard of this genre of like YouTube videos or mixes before until you wrote about it. Can you tell us about this?
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you know, there is kind of a internet era genre called vaporwave that, you know, people would edit music to sound like it was, you know, situated in any particular place. A shopping mall was one of them. And there's this sort of subculture of edits, of music edits on Tumblr and on YouTube, where these teenagers are editing songs to sound like they're playing, for example, you know, in an empty shopping mall, or, you know, from another room, or like, you know, in a closed room at a party. And I, you know, there's something about Africa in general, as we all know, that is extremely, you know, evocative and emotional. And the pathos of it playing, you know, edited to sound like it was playing in an empty shopping mall. And the fact that, you know, I interviewed the, you know, the teenager who did it, I found it really beautiful. There's this, you know, there's this hunger for physical connection, right? The internet, what it does is it kind of atomizes and isolates us in the set of, you know, our algorithmically determined and hardened preferences, you know? The algorithms figure out who we are, and then it just shows us more and more and more of that. And, you know, and it's kind of amazing to find these spaces where a hunger for the opposite of that emerges, right? A hunger for something where you're not listening to a personalized Spotify feed of what you already like in your ear. You know, it's a hunger for being physically connected in the way that the internet, you know, can never replicate, right? It's like these kids who are hungering for, you know, unmediated, you know, experience in a way.
You know, so I am of the age where I used to frequent those malls before many of them got shut down.
Right. And now kids get together on the internet. Like, there's no, like, spend 4 hours hanging out at the mall after school anymore. I think I caught the tail end of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a thing that people do.
What I find so fascinating about it, and you point this out in your essay, in your New Yorker essay about it, that you're talking about teenagers now, some of whom are definitely not old enough to ever have had a first-person experience of being in an almost empty mall and listening to Toto's Africa being played there. So they are evincing a nostalgia for something they haven't actually lived through, which is really fascinating to me. And then they're satisfying that nostalgia or seeking to satisfy it by recreating the sensation of a physical space through digital manipulation. I mean, that to me, it's very affecting. Like, I'm quite moved by that. But it is the epitome of the trick mirror that your whole book wrestles with.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so the internet, I think the dream about Twitter, right, is that it would always be like the Arab Spring forever, right? That it would be this truly democratic public sphere. Like, all of these platforms, they promised this type of, you know, incredible connection that was never possible before. And what they supplied instead, you know, they promised connection, but I think we are finding out that these platforms, what they inculcate is deep loneliness and deep isolation. And that juxtaposition is fascinating. And yeah, you know, I think the dream was that there would be open discourse, right? And the reality is that open discourse has become, you know, not necessarily anywhere near as possible as we once hoped.
Yeah. Well, let's, on this issue of the self-delusion and the trick and mirror of the internet, let's go to Diana, who's calling from Ithaca, New York. Diana, you're on the air with Gia Tolentino.
Hi. I'm a marriage and family therapist, and I think one of the most things that we're trying to focus on here is how to love. And that's why there's so many selfies and there's so much into Instagram, is that somebody is trying to find that connection to themselves and to be able to love. And I'm actually trying to get a healthy relationships course at the local high school for over 25 years and how to even have a healthy, loving relationship. And so everybody's going outside of that, you know, and not really getting to that core issue of how we really learn to love ourselves.
Well, Diana, thank you for your call. Gia, do you want to respond to her?
Yeah, well, one thing that I still love about the internet, and, you know, there are still so many great things, and there are, you know, I don't want to downplay this, the way that the internet can actually, you know, it's led to, for example, like Black Lives Matter, Me Too, Standing Rock, right? It has led to true connection and action, you know, in many cases. And I do think that there are lots, marginalized communities in particular have found, you know, comfort and solidarity and community in the internet and have been able to, you know, enact self-love and love for each other in, you know, in a special way there. And one thing that I still like about the internet, one thing that redeems it despite how nightmarish it feels to, you know, be on the internet all day if you have to, or just find yourself unable to not, is that I think so many of us are still trying to find ways to be human. And this applies to so much about our world in general. We're trying to find ways to be human in systems that incentivize a lack of humanity. And I find that moving to watch, you know, just like, you know, teens editing Toto's Africa to play in an empty shopping mall. Like, we're all trying to find some way to use these artificial systems to bring us around to something real.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about your real life experiences growing up, because I think the best essay in the book is the one titled Ecstasy, about
me
your
too, actually.
Your oh, you think so too? Good, because so does everybody else. Well, because this is the one where you sort of open the door for us to learn about your life growing up in a Texas megachurch. So talk to us about, first of all, talk to us about your family, and then you were basically like a member of the church from birth. Is that right?
Yeah. So my parents are from the Philippines, but I was born in Canada, but we moved to Houston, Texas when I was four.
Yeah.
And I spent from then on till the end of high school at a church attached to what is, you know, by some metrics, the second biggest megachurch in the whole country. It's a Southern Baptist place, extremely conservative. I spent my entire childhood and adolescence within this church that's as big as a city. You know, we would, like, tens of thousands of people would pass through the worship center. You know, it's this sort of six-story corporate cathedral in West Houston, you know, every weekend. And I went to school there every day, and I went to Bible class every day from first to 12th grade, and chapel every Thursday. And, you know, it was the full totality of my life.
And you and your friends had various nicknames for the church.
Oh, yeah. We called it, I say in the essay, we called it the Repentagon. That was my favorite. We also called it the Baptidome, Six Flags Over Jesus. I mean, it was really, it was an intense place, especially this was Bush era Texas. So the kind of hegemony of the situation was overpowering. Like, I didn't meet a Democrat until I went to college. I never knew anyone that was pro-choice or anti-war. I, you know, got my first promise ring, you know, that, like, I'd remain a virgin till marriage when I was in elementary school. It was just, it was a total world. It was a closed world.
Yeah.
I'm not conservative. I am not religious. This was my world for so long, and I hated so much about it, but I also, I'm so glad that I lived that way.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you, though, your parents weren't always evangelical, though.
They grew up Catholic in the Philippines, then they kind of defected from Catholicism and joined a small Baptist church in Toronto that was nothing like this church. And my parents were not particularly, you know, they are not very conservative. They're not dogmatic at all about their beliefs. But I think they grew up in Manila. They sort of thought private school is, you know, better than public school. And they just, you know, got me into this school where I was on scholarship like half the time.
So what did being members of the church bring to your parents? What did it give to them?
I think that, you know, a sense of community, right? Like, I think that's what everyone's looking for, you know, in church, in politics, in anything, you know, a sense of community, a grounding sense of morality. And I think in general, we like being told what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you talk about how your personal beliefs diverge from what was being taught to you for years. And I want to get to that. But you also, in this essay, you talk about how you did pray every night. You did feel genuinely blessed. Like,
oh, yeah.
it was a deep instinct, this feeling of being blessed. Can you tell more about that?
Yeah, you know, and I think that it's strange when you're not religious to – I went back and read all of my old journals, and I had forgotten exactly what this was like. You know, when you were a kid and you're in a Christian church – These ideas of good and evil are spelled out for you in a way that's extreme. I found very transcendent, you know, and incredibly comforting. This idea that there's a God looking out for you, I felt like I was walking around in a halo of golden light all the time. You know, I felt so comforted thinking about the plagues in Exodus, like rolling out like a horror movie. And, you know, this was like this kind of obscure aesthetic prescription about what was right and what was wrong. And I loved, you know, I think one of the reasons that I think it's still in my writing a little bit, this thing that I was trained to do, which was to, you know, kind of take an accounting every night and think about the ways in which I was lucky and think about the ways in which I could do better. You know, I think that instinct was encoded in me. And I think in many ways it's a good one. Yeah. And I was so fervently religious as a kid because it seemed so self-evident. So the essay called Ecstasy, it's about how that instinct to reach for a sense of ecstasy and transcendence, that has never left me, and it's never even lessened its power over me. It's just found different avenues.
Well, so can we talk about one of those avenues?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of what, MDMA itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, So I have always been interested in the ecstatic tradition in religion, right? It's this idea, it appears in every religion, not just Christianity, yeah. But there's a strong mystic Christian tradition that's largely female-centered in the medieval times, which I love. And, you know, it's this idea that through achieving ecstatic states of consciousness, you achieve union with God. And I find that beautiful. And then, you know, in Houston, I was in Houston the early 2000s. There was like the rap scene was really kind of thick and heady and intense then. And then I went to college and it was sort of like I was losing the ability to find that sense of union with mystery through religion, because mostly because of my deep political dissatisfaction with, you know, the Southern Baptist Convention. But I started to find it. And, you know, this is the feeling that I had when I would do drugs. It was this sort of sense of surrender and magnification and abasement and kind of glory. And the essay is about my confusion about those things and how deeply they're tied together with me and how I know one is not a substitute for the other. But nonetheless, there's still something there there's something about ecstasy that provides this link between virtue and vice. Like there was a period in the 60s, 70s where acid and MDMA were not, therapists could use them in their practice. And there would be these logs of patients that had PTSD or depression or whatever, and they would be using these drugs in guided sessions with therapists. And the things that they would say and the things that they would write down about feeling a connection and feeling blessed and about feeling, you know, a sense of light and peace and freedom, it sounded like what I was writing in my journal when I was 8 and thinking about God. And it sounds like what these saints were writing, you know, in the 12th century when they were experiencing right. communion with. There's a language through which ecstatic experiences are all very similar.
So you're a seeker for sure. But yeah. you talk about in the essay how you've been walking away from institutionalized religion. But have you been walking away from your belief in the divine?
You know, I don't know. You know, that's such a good question. I don't think I've ever really walked away from that, but I don't think that my sense of mystery and something beyond has never gone away. But it has become harder to access, I think, just naturally, you know, as you get older. And and the more that, you know, the internet is just rotting my brain, you know, like there are all these conditions in life where are not especially conducive to remembering that the world is full of wonder and mystery, right? And but, you know, I think I, like a lot of former Christians, I just reached some point in college where I was like, oh, God is the laws of physics, you know.
Right. Well, you know, we have to
shut.
We've got to take a break here in about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And you alighted quickly over the fact that when you were, in middle school, you also discovered, in your seeking nature, you discovered Houston hip hop.
Yeah.
tell us
Chopped
a little,
and screwed, baby.
Yeah, so like we're gonna hear a little bit of it in a second, but I'll give you 20 seconds to tell us, like, what was it about discovering Houston hip hop that was transformative for you?
There was something about that music, and it spoke to me the same way that a hymn did in church. It was totalizing. It was heady. It had this sense of kind of this absolute, like, you were just pinned to the wall with, like, kind of sensation. Right. I found it to be the exact same in a lot of ways.
Well, so what we're hearing right now is Southside Choppin' from the late DJ Screw, a central figure, maybe the central figure in the Houston hip-hop community. So we'll go out into the break with that. Gia, stand by for just a second. We're talking with Gia Tolentino. Her new book is Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. We'll be back. This is On Point. And what I recommend, you call up a friend, go half on a pint and blow the sweets in the wind. On the highway, it's a Friday, riding with the screw and SS in sideways. Man, hold up, I'm living life kind of fast. Can't predict my future, but forgive me for my past. In the game too deep, late night grief. With my partner doing what you want. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Gia Tolentino. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. Prior to that, she was deputy editor of the feminist website Jezebel. And she's author of a new book of essays titled Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. And we have an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. And let's go to Brian, who's calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. Ms. Tolentino, I'm a big reader of Jezebel still, so draw your own conclusions about my ideology. Regarding both the subtitle of your book, as well as just your thoughts on the internet in general, it seems like Twitter, as you know, can be such an echo chamber, and the more I'm on there, it's almost like a nasty habit. It feels like people are so concerned about being right, almost comes to feel like a purpose of being is to prove yourself right over and over again on social media. And I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on whether you think that's like part of the human, or whether you think it's something that's exacerbated by specifically Twitter with its, you know, no nuance, 280 characters, or what?
Yeah.
Brian, that's such a good question. I have been thinking about that a lot, and, you know, at Jezebel, I thought about this constantly. I think that to some degree, sort of wanting to perform, being correct and being right and maybe being superior is built into the human desire to interact with each other. Like, there's something about that that's baked in. But I do think that the internet systematizes it and, most importantly, monetizes it. And specifically on Twitter, I write about this in the book. I think one of the things, you know, given that it sort of programmatically revolves around personal identity, right? Like, everything you do is supposedly, no matter what you're saying about anything, the kind of implication is that it's a statement about you, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that what the internet does, and what Twitter does specifically, is it makes your identity sort of seem like it's composed of the opinions you have, right? And it makes those, you know, stating those opinions seem like the most meaningful action that you could possibly take. So I think that it, like, the conflation of your identity with the opinions you have, with the actions that you're taking in the world, I think it's built into Twitter. The platform is meant to make people confuse those things. And as a result, I think the natural, or like one inevitable result of that, is people, as you said, trying to prove themselves right over and over, because I think it can genuinely feel on Twitter like that's an action, right? Like, that's a meaningful action, when it actually is so self-evidently not. But the platform is structured to make us feel that way, and so we do it.
So, would you think that that one's identity, that there's a flow between one's identity and one's opinions, but not from that to conflating that with action? Because I guess I'm hung up a little bit about, like, when I think of who I am myself, I mean, that's an opinion I have of myself. So is that what identity is?
Well, I think, you know, as the internet makes it out to be that our opinions, let's say on politics, right, or on the primary or on whatever, you know, that's who we are, right? We are a set of opinions about the world, not even necessarily about ourselves. But one thing that I think about all the time is, you know, obviously, ourselves are so much more than what the algorithm can touch. You know, the algorithm is trying to, like, these social platforms are trying to contain and classify, right, and delineate who we are. But in reality, who you are and who I am, there, we are so much more than what we think about the world. You know, it's just not, the internet's vision of who we are is so inadequate and incomplete, and I try to remember that.
Well, let's switch gears here for a second, because as our caller mentioned, you were, before you were at The New Yorker, you were deputy editor at Jezebel. I'm just wondering, what's your view right now on... This is a reductive question. I'm going to apologize for the reductive question. But you've had some pretty complex thoughts about where feminism is now, and especially maybe, you know, feminism as expressed through online sources or the internet.
Yeah. So my take on the state of feminism?
Yeah, in 30 seconds.
Well, okay. One thing that I will say is that I think within the last couple of years, and you saw it especially in coverage of the Me Too movement, is that we're now getting to a point where it's understood that, you know, for example, sexual assault, 10 years ago, it's considered like a woman's issue, right? It's not. It's obviously a social problem that every, you know, it's a problem for everyone. It's not a niche thing. Like, women aren't a special interest group, right? Women are fully half, if not a little more, of the population. That's been amazing. One thing that I criticize a lot in my book is that as feminism has become kind of blessedly mainstream, right? Like, by the time I was done at Jezebel, the audience was half male and half female, which was something that not a lot of people knew and that I was proud of, this idea that it was kind of becoming quietly self-evident that women's issues were people's issues in general. At the same time, you know, in order for feminism to become mainstream, it's had to become marketable. And I think that there are a lot of things about the versions of feminism that are the most marketable that I take issue with, like such as the idea that kind of the most progressive and important thing we can imagine, the most feminist thing we can imagine is, you know, like a woman getting super rich, you know. I take a lot of issue with that.
Well, in the book, you also write about some particular moments recently that you had some pretty strong reactions to. So I just want to play one of them. This is from 2018 when comedian Michelle Wolf, she was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. She hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner, was pretty widely criticized initially from both sides of the aisle about some of the jokes that she made, particularly about then White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. So here's Michelle Wolf.
I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts and then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies. It's probably lies.
Now, you hear even in the audience there the initial kind of discomfort with that joke.
It's a pretty good joke, honestly.
Yeah. And look, so what's your take about not so much the joke, but how people reacted to it?
Yeah. So I think that one of the things that's happened within the last 10 years, partly because of this wave of online feminism at places like Slate's Double X and Jezebel and, you know, lots of places, is that, you know, as a culture, we, and particularly women, have gotten quite good at ferreting out sexist criticism and identifying it as such, rightfully, right? What that has bled into is this desire to, you know, this desire to defend women against any criticism that could in any possible way intersect with sexism at all, which I think we've seen with a lot of women in the Trump administration has really dead-ended this conversation over and over. Like, after Michelle Wolf made this joke, for like a week, you know, the news cycle was that joke sexist? Like, is it sexist to make a joke about her makeup? Is it sexist? How sexist is it? And it was like, that's just, that's not important. You know, that's not the point. The same thing happened with Melania Trump when she wore that I don't really care, do you jacket when she was visiting the kids at the border. You know, people criticized her for wearing that jacket, that monstrous jacket. And then, you know, the White House was like, you know, don't criticize a woman. You know, she can wear whatever she wants, which is nominally a feminist idea. But this feminist toolkit of defending women against unfair criticism is now being used as a shield to protect women in general against any criticism generally. And one of the ways that this happens is that the news cycle gets swallowed into this question of, is it sexist? You know, was that misogynistic? When the real issue is there are children in cages at the border, right? That Sarah Sanders is consistently lying and lying and lying and lying. And the sort of well-meaning instinct has become this shield.
Well, you say it's now being used.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't this the inevitability when what was the, like you said, the well-meaning instinct at the beginning initially was one of don't be sexist? Like, you can't just choose, like, don't be sexist towards Democratic women who work in a White House in an administration, and it's okay to sort of make comments about Republican women who work in an administration.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that I think that we should, you know, based on that, because I lean so far left that I think it's completely fine to make fun of any Republican woman's looks. I mean, that's not at all what I think. Mm-hmm. What I mean is that, you know, debating whether or not a pretty anodyne joke about eyeshadow is sexist is kind of objectively not that important, you know?
Yeah.
It is just what I'm talking about is the ability of that question to distract from the issues at hand.
So let me ask you, I actually completely agree with you, because when you listen to what Michelle Wolf's joke actually is, it's about Sarah Sanders lying to the press every time she stepped into that White House press room. But people didn't hear that. Like, we have been trained. Oh my gosh, I'm ready. I'm waiting for the emails to come to me. But we've been trained to not be able to hear the subtleties anymore. We just hear sexism.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. I guess I think about this all the time. I feel so conscious of being young enough that I have had so many more freedoms available to me than writers, women, you know, 5, 10, 20 years before me had. And one of those freedoms is to understand scale here, right? To understand, here is the importance of a joke about eyeshadow that may or may not, you know, be sexist. Like, here is the importance of the White House speaker lying to the press every day, right? And those things are different. And I feel that, you know, in this day and age, we must take advantage of every freedom we have. And one of those is for me to not care that much about a joke about eyeshadow about anyone on either side of the aisle. Like, it's more important to think about the structural issues at hand. And I feel like I have grown up in a time where feminism has been, you know, I've been able to trust that that's okay, that I could not always need to be adjudicating sexism as the primary, you know, the most important thing.
Yeah. Well, let's see if we can get one more call here. Melissa is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Gia. I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on procrastination as a form of self-delusion or self-deception, and what roles do social media and all the things that you've been talking about as a causation of procrastination, and what long-term impacts that might have?
Yeah, so there's this great book that came out this year that I've been talking about nonstop called How to Do Nothing by Jenny O'Dell, and she writes about... She writes about distraction, which I think is close enough to procrastination in the way you're talking about it. She talks about one thing that I think social media does, and one of the reasons that I think it's, you know, it's completely intertwined with the kind of decline in civic structures that we're seeing all over the country. See, she says that, you know, that the civic body, if it's distracted, is like a distracted person. You know, when you're personally distracted, you can't focus, you can't think clearly, and you can't act. And I think you see that we can experience that at an individual level. I think a lot of people have had the experience of, you know, looking up from an hour spent on some social media and you're just like, what did I just do? You know, you are distracted, you're scattered, your attention is splintered. And when you have that effect writ large on, you know, a national community, you know, when we as a community is like a body that can't communicate with itself, can't move clearly and move correctly, I think that the internet is a huge part of that in that way.
Yeah. Well, so we have about 3 minutes left, Gia, and I'm going to give you a choice, okay? Do you want to talk about your appearance on reality TV?
Sure.
Or do you want to talk about beluga whales?
Oh my God, let's talk about beluga whales,
okay.
Please.
Okay, so let's play a little bit of music to introduce our conversation about beluga whales. This might be my favorite conversation for a while because we are covering so much ground, but here
it
is. I know,
I'm so grateful for you.
Here's a little music. This is a mariachi band playing at the Mystic Aquarium in Connecticut in front of a beluga whale exhibit. So tell us, why is it that we are playing this music now, Gina?
This is the background picture on my Twitter profile. It's a beluga whale kind of smiling at a mariachi guy. And I strongly encourage anyone listening to this to Google beluga mariachi on YouTube and just watch the video start to finish. It's really, the internet may be worth it just for this video alone. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
why?
Every time I watch it. Because it just feels like a miracle. You watch it and it's a miracle. It's this mariachi band playing to a beluga that is the beluga is loving it.
More than and a little anthropomorphizing there.
I know. It's so like, this is like me being like a 65-year-old mom, like sending cross animal, cross species friendships to myself all the time. Like this is also a big part of me. There's something about this video.
Okay. Look, I'm going to... You could also interpret it as the beluga. Belugas, like, always look like they're smiling a little bit. But
yeah,
this could be a whale still thinking, I'm still in captivity, and they're subjecting me to this music now,
this beluga
too.
Could be thinking about, like, how can I break through this wall and drown these mariachis?
Okay, but it's giving you more than a little bit of joy. So that's why I'm glad you picked that one here. We've got a minute left to go, Gia, and it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. But
thank you so much.
From a pure journalistic standpoint, I wanted to ask you, are you the youngest staff writer at The New Yorker?
No, there are a couple younger than me.
Okay.
I'm not the baby. But I came in at a time when The New Yorker was consciously wanting to kind of shake things up a little bit. And so in the last couple of years since I got there, they've hired a lot more younger writers, writers of color, especially to write on the internet and to, spice things up a little bit. And I've been really grateful that I've gotten to be a part of that.
Well, I think they've chosen extremely well because you've brought a new voice that obviously meets the magazine's editorial and journalistic standards. And we see that loud and clear in this new book. So the book is Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. It's a book of essays by Gia Tolentino. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker. And we have an excerpt of Trick Mirror at our website, onpointradio.org. Gia, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure. Thank you for playing that beluga video. Wow.
We always aim to please here. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.